I was a girl, I had a favorite story of the meadowlark who lived where the rivers wind. Her voice could match the angels in its glory, but she was blind. The lark was blind. The king of the rivers took her to his palace, where the walls were burnished bronze and golden braid. And he fed her fruit and nuts from an ivory chalice, and he prayed, "Sing for me, my meadow lark, sing for me of the silver morning, set me free, my meadow lark, and I'll buy you a priceless jewel and cloth of brocade and crewel, and I'll love you for life if you will sing for me."
Patti LuPone is a two-time Tony Award winner for her performances as Madame Rose in the most recent Broadway revival of the musical Gypsy, and her now legendary performance in the title role in Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice's Evita. Patti LuPone most recently starred on Broadway as cosmetics pioneer Helena Rubinstein in the musical War Paint, and will be returning to London's West End stage in Marianne Elliott's new production of the Stephen Sondheim George Firth musical Company later this year. Her brand new, isn't that exciting? Her brand new album is Don't Monkey With Broadway, where she explores wonderful Broadway show tunes, as well as talks about her lifelong love affair with Broadway and her concern for what the Great White Way is becoming today. I hope you will join me in welcoming Patti LuPone to Page Hall.
It's a nice crowd. It's a very nice crowd.
It sure is. Good. I'm going to cry.
They love you. They love you.
What? At what point did you say to yourself, not only, I want to be on stage, but at the point where you were, not only am I doing what I wanted to do, but this is what I want to continue doing. I love this.
Well, it started when I was 4 years old, and I was in Miss Marguerite's dance studio, and we were giving a recital on the Ocean Avenue Elementary School stage, and I was tap dancing downstage right, and I looked out at the audience, and I thought they were all looking at me, and they were smiling, and literally at 4 years old, I went, "Hey, I can't get in trouble up here. I can do whatever I want, and they'll still smile at me." So I never looked back. It was sort of it was this odd connection. It was it just happened. And what I fell in love with was the audience.
Is that essentially true that, I mean, obviously, I'm sure you have examples of where that isn't the case, but that it is safe. You can do what you want up here, and they'll respond.
It depends, of course. Well, of course you can do whatever the director wants you to do up here.
Yeah.
And I find that I have freedom on stage. I'm fearless on stage, and I'm filled with fear in my own life. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, and so the directors I prefer are the ones that are really left of center. I prefer sort of the European directors that have a very strong concept, and I prefer to be challenged in doing stuff that is difficult to physicalize, perhaps, with the character's intentions. It's such a challenge for the actor to be able to understand that our only job is to fulfill the playwright with the direction of the guidance of the director, his concept.
Right.
And instead of fighting it, do you know what I mean? Like, a lot of actors might say, if the director said, "Now stand on your head and give that speech," some actors might go, "Well, that my character wouldn't do that." Well, your character does what the director wants you to do. You know what I mean? And the more challenging it is, the more exciting it is for me.
So let's use Gypsy as an example. In reading your book, you went and you did this for, what was it, three nights? Was it a three-nighter initially?
Mm-hmm. When at the Ravinia Festival in Chicago.
The Ravinia Festival. And you knew it was going to be a different interpretation of Gypsy.
No, I didn't know anything. The only Gypsy that I had seen, I was in Gypsy when I was 15 years old, I played Louise to Kathy Sheldon's Madame Rose. And I remember in the dressing room scene, we're teenagers, and in the dressing room scene, she's yelling at me, and I'm like, and I'm a 15-year-old going, what's she talking about? I couldn't understand the scenes.
Yeah.
I remember that production because we were kids, and I remember that. Then I saw another production. I saw the movie. I didn't see Tyne. I certainly didn't see Ethel do it. I didn't see anybody else do it. And also, I've done revivals before. I've done Anything Goes, which was Ethel's part, and I did Sweeney Todd, which was Angie's part. I always start from the script. I don't start out going, I'm going to make this different than somebody else's interpretation. I start out with the script. And because we're all individuals, we will all interpret differently. And so what I saw was someone that was fiercely protective of her kids, recognized their talent, and forced them into doing, you know, being in vaudeville.
You'll be swell, you'll be great, gonna have the whole world on a plate, starting here, starting now. Honey, everything's coming up roses.
And at the end, you realize that she was doing it for herself, but you can't play the end, really. I don't know if my interpretation was that much different. I mean, I will also find the joke. I will also want people to laugh. And I think it's very human. I think Stanislavski says you can't play a villain unless you show them their good sides. So how would you know it's a villain? Do you know what I mean? Unless you see the dynamic of the character.
So how in rehearsal, how in working it out through both the Ravinia Festival and then eventually making it to Broadway, did you find that of, oh, not only can I bring this out in this character, but I can also make sure that I hit the jokes
well,
that
I
want to
hit? Well, this is interesting because Wells Kaufman, the CEO of Ravinia, wanted me to play this part, but there's a long story here. I had been banned from Arthur's work.
Arthur Lawrence.
I had been banned from it. I'm going, why me? Why does that always happen to me? He had offered me a play right after Sunset Boulevard, and I was literally raw meat, emotionally distraught. And I, you know, they actually came to my house in Connecticut, and not Arthur, but the producer two producers, Scott Rudin and Robert Fox, and they wanted me to do this play. And I read the play, and I thought, it's not so great. And it was called Jolson Sings Again, and it was about an agent, her husband, a choreographer, and a director, and it was about Jolson being Larry Parks, who sang to the House Un-American Activities Committee. He gave up names. And this was, and in Arthur's world, it would have been Jerome Robbins and Elia Kazan. And the play, just I didn't feel was that good. And I did say, is it coming to New York? And they said, no, it'll be at the Seattle Rep. And I went, I just came back from London, and I'm going to go to Seattle for a show that's not even coming into New York, which is not a great play. So I passed on it. It came back again. And then they sent me down to, my manager sent me down to Arthur Lawrence's house by myself. Well, I'm, as I said, scared to death in my own life. And I went, well, okay, I'll go. But I found myself in his presence saying yes. What are you going to say? Talk to my agent? What's the salary? Let me think about it. You say, yes, he's Arthur Lawrence. Then the offer came in, which was really insulting. So we turned it down. Then again, I'm making a film in Montreal, David Mamet's Heist. Mm. And I get a telephone call in my hotel room. How they found me, I'll never know. And Arthur does what his reputation has said he does. And I was shocked, and I was speechless, and I was crying, and the next thing I know, I was banned from all of his work. And then I thought, you know, okay, well, all right, I mean, why me? When Ravinia happened, he had no control over concert versions, only first-class productions in Broadway. Mm. So we did it at Ravinia, and the buzz was good enough that it interested Broadway producers. When nothing happened after Ravinia, I was told to call Scott Rudin. Scott Rudin told me to call Arthur, and it was the hardest phone call I think I've ever made, to call the man who has banned me from his work and who just demolished me on a phone call. Mm-hmm. And I called, I said, Arthur, it's Patty. And he said, he complimented me on Sweeney Todd and proceeded to go straight into casting. And he was going to direct. And it was another shock. And when we started rehearsal for City Center, which was the first production in New York, he brought the 1989 prompt book and stage management, which was Tyne Daly's production, and assembled a brilliant company. And City Center would not give him 3 weeks rehearsal with the entire company. So he said, can I have the principals for the first week? So for the first week, we read the play and spoke the lyrics. But in the course of that week, every time someone said a line, he would stop them and go, no, this is the way you do it. And you saw the entire company. Well, he hit Alison Fraser a lot, Laura and Boyd. He didn't, for some reason, didn't do anything with me. But he would stop and say, this is the way it's written. And this, and his stage management, we're looking at these old guys going, oh my God, they should be retired at this point. But we kept asking him about the play. We just kept asking him to explain why this was happening. Why did they, when they were on the road, why did they go from Iowa to Boston to California? What was the Orpheum circuit? And Arthur started to listen to his play. And he gave up directing and started, the playwright started working on the play. And he finally, they closed the 1989 prompt book and he let the actors he cast find the way to deliver that laugh line organically so that when we had a production, it was vital, it was alive, and it was extraordinary. It was an extraordinary, we all did it for Arthur. And Arthur did it for his late lover, his late partner, 50 years they had been together, he had just died. To see Arthur, and I said to Arthur at one point in rehearsal, I said, oh, is this from the 89 production? He said, nothing is from the 89 production. And I thought, great, he's letting us discover it. There's only, you know, there's a finite amount of ways to land a joke, but you have to be able to have it come from you organically. You can't imitate someone else's delivery.
Right.
You may end up delivering it exactly the same way, but you have to find that joke within yourself. You have to know how to land it.
We are in conversation with actress and musical legend Patty LuPone as part of The Creative Life, a conversation series recorded on April 26th at Page Hall in Albany, New York.
Was there ever any trepidation on your part when you find yourself saying yes again to Arthur Lawrence of, okay, I'm not banned anymore, so that's good, but I'm going to be spending a lot of time with the person that I had this bad experience with.
Yeah, I mean, I was scared. I was very scared. And, you know, what can you say? You know, I was scared. As a matter of fact, he yelled at me again. I love you, Arthur! He yelled at me again when it came time for the, you know, he wanted to bring it to London. And it was just a lousy deal, and he yelled at me again, as if I, you know, killed our production in London. And he wasn't talking to me when he died.
Oh, wow.
It's crazy. Show business is crazy. It's cruel. It's I don't know, it's a lot of things, you know, and you just wish it would be just joyful, and it's not. There's a lot of stuff going on.
So does that change how you... Not how you perform, but how you think about and choose material if you have that backstory with an individual. I mean, do you look...
Yes, I will never work with Hal Prince again. Ever.
Why?
Because of my treatment in Evita. And that was it. You know, and he offered me roles after that, and I turned them down. And at that time, he didn't know why, but... I will never work with him again. But I'm one of many actors that won't work with him again.
No, because in your book, you had problems with him, but you also had problems with Andrew Lloyd Webber too, right?
No, not at Evita.
No, okay.
No, Evita was, they were rarely around, you know, Tim and Andrew. They weren't quite, Andrew wasn't quite who he was. Well, Phantom happened, I was doing Anything Goes, so it was Evita, and Evita got vilified. Evita... You know, the critics, and we did a pre-Broadway tour in Los Angeles and San Francisco and then came into New York, and we were vilified because They didn't like the fact that British composers were usurping what is an American institution, musical theater. They didn't like the fact that they were glorifying a Nazi sympathizer. So when we got to New York, we were just dismissed by the critics, which is worse than being hated by the critics. At least there's passion in that. Do you know what I mean? We were just dismissed. And I remember Mandy and I, because we worked very hard. That play is episodic. Do you know what I mean? She did this, and then she moved there, and then she moved there, and then she moved there, and then she moved there. Very little dramatic action happens. You have to supply it in the exposition. Mandy, when the reviews came out, Mandy and I said to Mandy, you want to go out for a drink? He said, yeah, and we walked silently down 8th Avenue to Joe Allen's, and at the same time, simultaneously burst into tears because we had worked so hard. And I will say, Hal's production was innovative and a benchmark. It was an extraordinary visual production. I remember standing on stage going, because there were shin busters, which are balletic lights to show off the lower leg. And there were lights coming out of the floor. It was David Hersey. It was an incredible production. But again, you know, I was, we talk about the Me Too movement and never again. I was emotionally abused. And I was emotionally abused because I think I was a woman, because I was an unknown, and because he could. So, you know, when I don't ever remember being on the casting couch with anybody, you know, being offered. I'm not that type of person. They looked at me out the door. not in. We're not interested. But in on stage, I have been mentally and emotionally abused by directors, and especially Hal. That was tough. That was my first experience. It's so weird because he cast me. I always wonder why directors abuse their cast. They cast us. Why right. Do they now not trust us? Because they don't trust themselves. That's what that's about. Do you know what I mean? It is.
Did you see similar behavior of how he treated you to how he treated Mandy?
Oh, no, Mandy. Mandy, I watched this go down. I really did, and I was so envious of Mandy, how he was able to handle this. Hal is not an actor's director. Hal can make a beautiful scene, but Hal doesn't know how to deal with actors' issues. And I don't mean actors' issues. What's the word I'm looking for? Actors need information. You need information. Why am I doing this? Why am I moving in that direction? What does this mean? Motivation. And that's not Hal's strength at all. He doesn't want to deal with the actors. And I remember Mandy at one point leaped across the stage because he said to Hal, what do I do here? And Hal said, do whatever you want. And Mandy literally leaped across the stage. And I went, why is Mandy leaping across the stage? Because Hal said, do what you want. And that's what Mandy did. He leapt across the stage. It was bizarre, but that's what Mandy did. And Mandy, he was as scared as I was. We had a moment in Los Angeles where we both just fell into each other's arms because we were both paralyzed with fear. I couldn't sing the role. I could act it. That was not the issue. Mandy and I had a shorthand on stage so that, you know, there were no questions asked. Whatever he said, whatever he did, I understood, accepted, and gave it back to him. But the singing was impossible. And I found myself blowing the LA opening and then blowing the San Francisco opening. But working with somebody in the cast, started to work with somebody in the cast in Los Angeles. But when the director doesn't understand fear in his actors, or how to guide them through that, through anything that is preventing them from fulfilling his concept, then there's something wrong. There's, you know, the director is the leader of the event. He's the captain of the ship. And he is responsible for ensuring comfort on stage in order for him to get his actors to do what they need to do to fulfill a concept. And that didn't happen. I mean, my performance in Evita, here's another that was so interesting. I got this role when I was shooting 1949, is that the name of it? Steven Spielberg's
yes.
Movie, Flop. Yeah. 1949, I couldn't believe it. I was in Hollywood. It was like incredible. and it was Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
And had one line, say you devil, how's about a deviled egg? That was my line. I was in the USO scene. So I got the role, And then I was staying with a friend, and I was in his house, and I went, oh my God, I'm going to go on this roller coaster ride, because there was so much hype about Evita before the casting, what a huge success it was in London, and you know, broke box office records, and it's the greatest thing that's ever, all that kind of stuff. Everybody in America wants to play the part. There was so much hype, more hype than any musical before or since. So much hype. So when I got the part, I was by myself, and I reflected. I went, oh my God, I'm going to go on a roller coaster ride. And then I thought, so did Evita Perón. I'm going to, and I registered, there was a smile on my face. I went, okay, first clue on how to play this part. Mm-hmm. First day of rehearsal, Hal said, literally, I want gnarled hands and no smiles. And I thought, oh dear, I'm going in the opposite direction. I took Hal's direction, got to Los Angeles, it didn't work. For me, it didn't work. There was, you know, after we opened in Los Angeles, I started to structure a performance from the material that I had, beat by beat. And my hairdresser actually said, when Hal came out, he thought I was going to be fired, because it was exactly the opposite of how Hal directed me. And Hal said, that's what I wanted. You go, okay. Yeah. So Mandy and I pieced these performances together with each other in fear. And I went on stage every single night in fear, because I couldn't sing it. And why couldn't I sing it? Because I didn't have technique. It's in the passaggio of a soprano's voice. It's in the weakest part. All those high notes are right where the voice is the weakest. Huh. Yeah, it was a nightmare. And it only became a pleasure when I did it in Australia 3 months after I ended the New York run. It was hard. It was the hardest lesson of my life in this business.
I don't really think I need the reasons why I won't succeed. I haven't started. Let's get this show on the road. Let's make it obvious. Bet on is off and rolling.
Patti LuPone is our guest on the roundtable this morning as part of the Creative Life, a conversation series recorded on April 26th. We will continue with our conversation after this short break.
Here's to the ladies who lunch, everybody love. Lounging in their caftans and planning a brunch on their own behalf. Off to the gym and to a fitting, claiming their fat. And looking grim, 'cause they've been sitting, choosing a hat. Does anyone still wear a hat? I'll drink to that.
Welcome back to the roundtable and to our conversation with musical legend Patti LuPone, recorded on April 26th at Page Hall in Albany, New York.
This past fall, you're walking down Broadway and you see a sign for Prince of Broadway. Do you just like how do you compute that? Do you just like give it the finger? Or what do you do when you see? Or is it that just the nature of the business?
Am I alone in wondering why a director has to celebrate himself? Am I alone in that? I mean, and he did not direct all the ones he produced. Some of them. He didn't direct them all, but it looked as though he was directing all of them. It's self-aggrandizement is what it is, in my opinion.
So is you were talking about the business, but is that rare?
What?
In Broadway to find that type of ego, that type of self-aggrandizement, because you've obviously worked with a lot of wonderful people.
Yes, I have. I mean, I was actually when in stream of consciousness, if anybody asked me, you know, who were the directors I didn't want to work with, my answer would be, let me tell you about the directors I loved working with, because there are more of those that are genuine directors, love their actors, know what they're doing, create incredible environments as we're working, and then that comes out on stage. You know, the audiences, that's electric, and it's vital. It's just very vital. There was a generation, it seems to me, of the men and women that created musical theater that thought that it had to be brutal, for actors and dancers, that the way to get something was to be vicious and destructive. Maybe it did work back then. Maybe some of the actors and the dancers. I mean, Jerome Robbins, the famous story about the dancers in West Side Story, allowing him to fall into the orchestra pit. That's how much, I'm presuming, they hated him. You heard that story, right? He's walking backwards, and the dancers are watching him, and he falls into the orchestra pit. Nobody stops him.
Let him go.
I just finished working with Michael Greif.
Yes.
On War Paint. And that's somebody that trusts his casting, knows how to rehearse, is incredibly organized in the rehearsal process of a musical, knows how to direct actors because he's not just a musical theater director, and is also just this great guy that doesn't want to lord over anybody, just wants everybody to do their best. That was a great experience. And John Doyle, Sweeney Todd, was a great experience. John is, again, he's a teacher. We were recreating. That was it had been done in London. We were recreating. But we were rehearsed extremely well. And actually, our stage manager said, you're more like a band than you are like a group of actors. And because we fought like a band, and a marching band at that, there was a lot of care because it was a dangerous set.
I would think with somebody like Michael in War Paint, but at this point in your career, that they're learning from you as well.
I think so, because if they cast me, they're trusting me now. And so I saw this in London, and it was remarkable. There is a dialogue between the actor and the director on stage that we don't have in America, that an actor will challenge the director. And the director and the actor have a dialogue about whether it's direction or whether it's interpretation. Mm. And we don't necessarily have that in the States. And years ago, I was taught a very valuable lesson. This was before Evita. And I've held on to it. And only recently has it come to pass for me. We were doing The Water Engine, a play by David Mamet at Joe Pappas Public Theater in the Martinson Theater. And they would serve wine and pecan pie, etc., and it was almost a cabaret environment. But when Colin Stinton came downstage, the on-air light, it was a radio play, the on-air light would come on, and the audience took this theatrical leap, and they were quiet. And he'd say, welcome to WCMJ 890 on your radio dial, broadcasting to our 89 affiliates across America. Everybody went, okay, we're on the air. When it was a very successful play. It was a play within a play. We broke out of the radio acting and became the characters in front of the microphones, etc. Very powerful piece of theater about someone that invents a water engine and is killed by the government, but not before he mails the plans to the pharmacist's son. It's a wonderful play. It was a big hit, so Joe wanted to move it uptown. And they were going to drop the fourth wall. The fourth wall is this place right here on stage. In musicals, we break it all the time and sing to you. In plays, they rarely break it. Do you know what I mean? It's the wall. It's if you see an actor looking out into mid-space, they're thinking. They're not engaging with the audience. You do that in musicals. But they were going to put up the fourth wall. And Colin said, he said to Joe Papp, David Mamet, and Stephen Schachter, you can only be an audience member once. Then you start to second-guess the audience. We start at A every single night, and you never take our perspective into consideration. And I thought, it's so true. Nobody knows better than the actor. We are on stage telling the story to the audience. We're the ones that have that communication, not the director, not the producer, not the playwright. And so when directors trust the actors, is this going to work? Maybe, maybe not. Let's try it this way. Okay. Then you've got a communication with your director, and that's what I had with Michael. And with Sweeney, it was different because we were, again, recreating something, and it was a very complicated dance on stage. But with Michael, he trusted his two leading ladies and the two leading men to... Is this going to work? Yes, I think so, but let's try this adjustment. And he allowed that to happen. His ego wasn't threatened. His talent wasn't threatened. His desire was to make it the best he could. And if the actors thought this would work better, he trusted we had the knowledge.
I was fascinated when it was announced that you were going to do War Paint, and only because I guess you were doing a show at Lincoln Center.
Shows for days.
Yes, and there was the event where the woman had the cell phone in her hand and you snatched it out of her hand.
No, I did not snatch. Okay. It was sleight of hand.
Okay, all right.
Even I was shocked I got the phone. And I'll tell you that story later, but people say snatched. Oh, no, no, no.
No, well, because you were exiting.
Smooth as silk.
Exiting and took
oh,
it.
Oh, no. There was no snatching there. I was shocked I got it. Anyway, go ahead.
But you released a statement a day later, and you said, I'm defeated by this.
Yeah.
I'm defeated. I don't feel like I, and I'm paraphrasing you, but you, I feel defeated by this, and I feel like I shouldn't have to put on battle armor.
Right.
With
to
the
patrol
audience.
An audience and perform at the same time. Absolutely right.
So how did that wear off, if you will, to say, all right, I'm going to go on Broadway and make a full commitment again and come back and say, in a time where still technology is only getting worse, not better, as far as the intrusion that it causes,
right.
Was that even something that you were
thinking about?
Oh, no.
I mean, everybody is aware of my commitment to whatever. But I'm not the only one. Let's start from the very beginning.
No.
Richard Griffith stopped History Boys. A lot of people have stopped shows. What audiences don't know is how many times actors go off stage, tell their stage manager what's going on in the audience. Stage manager alerts house manager. House manager sends ushers down. Audiences don't know how many times that actually happens. In this particular case, it was the Mitzi Newhouse, which is in a Greek arena. Very small.
Yeah.
There's seating on the sides. Here's the stage. Seating on the sides and in front. And in this particular show, the stage light spilled out until about three rows up on the sides. And this woman was sitting in the last seat on the side, right next to the exit stage right. And she had been texting for the entire first act. She never put her phone down. Her husband or boyfriend watched the play, and she was like this. And she'd show him and continue. We all came off stage. There were five of us. We went, can you believe that woman? She's not going to be there in the second act. She hates this. What can you do? Dale Soles and I come on stage for the second act, and I'm facing Dale, and I can see her, and she's still texting. She must have stayed in her seat. I don't know what. She was writing a book, something. And I'm thinking, Dale's talking. I'm going, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And then I thought, oh, I got it. I think I got it. And so I would make this exit stage right, and there was a pole that I stopped at, and I would say, and remember, ladies and gentlemen, community theater has the word community in it. And I would then, and this was my invention, Jerry Zaks is another one who was so brilliant to work with, I would shake the hands of the first two people in the row. Well, this particular night, I skipped them, went over to her, looked her in the eye, touched her on her sleeve, and palmed it. I didn't even look it. I just palmed it. And I came off stage and I went, I got the phone! And my stage manager, who was up in the gods, went, you got the phone! Everybody could see, and there was a gasp in the audience because they could see what I had just done. The big mistake I made was giving it to my stage manager, who then gave it to the house manager to give it back to her at the end of the show. I should have held on to it and said, if you want your phone back, you got to come downstairs and answer a few questions. That's what I should have done. But yeah. I have to tell you about what's going on now. Because that made such news. For the rest of our run, our ushers, there's flyers, not flyers, what do you call them? Inserts
in the
programs. And the ushers go up and down the aisle telling people to turn mm-hmm. their phones off. And they do that again in intermission. I am now a Tony voter, and I'm going to a lot of theater. And I have to say, I have not heard a phone go off. And that has nothing to do with me. That has to do with everybody in the theater community and audiences demanding that one person who's ruining it for everybody, knock it off. Stop.
Yeah.
one of the stories that came out, because the Times wrote about it right after it happened, and the story that they linked it to was Hand of God was playing.
Oh, my God!
And one of the audience members, they have if you've seen the show, it takes place in a church basement.
Oh, my God,
and
this idiot.
A guy climbed up on stage to plug his cell phone into a fake
A fake outlet. But this is where we're at now in the country as far as admission, I suppose, is the word I'm looking for. The guy never said he was sorry. He said, look at how much press I brought to the show.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a real low life, but a real low. What idiot would just jump on the stage and plug his cell phone into? And how did he not figure it's not charging?
Right. Yeah, you're not getting anything.
But I have to say, no, I've been to a lot of theater, and I've been shocked that phones have not gone off. And maybe it's the night I've gone. I don't know. But I think audiences are being more vigilant about the people that are using their phones. And, you know, someone said, did you hear the phone go off? Was it, I don't know if it was war paint. It must have been war paint. And I said, no, I didn't hear it, but it went off. But now what's happening is if it goes off, they're on it immediately.
Right.
I think they're afraid of what I might do. Take a flying leap into the audience. Strangle them with their own phone.
But it does. It makes you wonder this whole idea of combating an audience. But the opposite of that is when you have them, right? When you have that audience, when you know you have them, and there must be nothing like that.
There isn't. You have to have skill, discipline, experience to walk across a stage. And if you have skill, experience, and discipline, audiences see that, and they immediately relax. And once they relax, because they don't have to worry about you, you can tell the story. And that's all it is. It's all just going on stage going, I got this, relax. Now, come on, wait till you hear this story. Do you know what I mean? That's all it is. It's walking on stage without audiences smelling your fear, really.
Hmm. Well, is that confidence? Isn't that what that is?
Well, it's experience. Yep. It's skill. And it's discipline. Do you know what I mean? This is not easy. This takes a lot of craft. It takes a lot of discipline. It takes a lot of sacrifice. It takes a lot of hard work to command an audience. And they expect that. And they deserve that. They're already paying so much money for the tickets that they deserve the best they can get. Not somebody that they're worried about, that they're disinterested in because they're not talking loud enough, because they can't hear them. Do you know what I mean? So I just think that's all it is. It really is as simple as that.
Patti LuPone is a two-time Tony Award winner for her performances as Madame Rose in Gypsy and her now legendary performance in the title role in Andrew Lloyd Webber's Evita. She spoke with us on April 26th at Page Hall in Albany.
Well, let me just ask this question, which is, so the new CD, Don't Monkey Around Broadway, how do you believe that we fix where we are right now?
You know, I've seen a lot of stuff, and I'm just... The thing that really... I have two complaints. My two complaints about Broadway this season, or any season, is the price of the ticket. It's become an elitist sport, not a popular sport. It's ridiculous. You can't go. And it's too... When I go to the musicals, it's too loud. I'm not deaf. And so I don't understand why the musicals are so loud, because what's happening is I can't follow the plot, because the plot are lyrics. And if it's so loud and I can't hear the lyrics, but I'm only getting the gist of the song, I'm being robbed. So, and I think it's like sound designers, you know, all went into a bar and went, okay, it's decibel 8 this season. But I've seen SpongeBob, Frozen, Mean Girls. They're all wonderful productions. And there's so much talent on the stage, it's staggering how talented these people are. But it's too loud. It's just too loud. I don't know why they think if it's quieter, you're not going to listen. The audience isn't going to listen. The audience is then allowed to come to the stage as opposed to being pushed back in their seats.
You're a Tony nominator.
No, voter.
Well, you're a Tony voter. What do you like? This season, what do you like?
I've liked everything. I've liked everything so far. I mean, I was actually surprised that I liked you know, the Disney stuff, the
Frozen.
SpongeBob and Frozen, and I was delighted by them. And I think I told you that. I mean, I've seen enough theater to have a very critical eye, and I'm in it, and I want it to be great. And when it's not, I'm really upset, just because why not? Why wasn't it? What happened? Do you know what I mean? At that ticket price. But I've seen a lot of the plays. My favorite play so far, I think, was The Children, which was a British import.
Beautiful, yeah.
And my favorite musical has to be The Band's Visit because of David Yazbek. And because it's quiet. It's quiet. It's a departure from the musicals that we see. And it's the story itself. It's so inspiring.
Do you feel like we're in a good place on Broadway?
I don't think you can ever kill Broadway. I don't think, you know, they when there was that crash when I was doing Gypsy, when we had the Wall Street crash, Richard Schlesinger came and interviewed me, expecting me to say, oh, we're going to suffer. I went, mm-mm. In bad times, show business succeeds, and in good times, show business succeeds. I think we need it, and we especially need it now when there's so much chaos in our country and confusion in our country. We need something that is going to focus a positive feeling. Do you know what I mean? Even if you're seeing a drama, but something that fulfills you, you know, enriches your soul.
Patti LuPone, ladies and gentlemen.
Due to landscape gardeners gifted, Father Knickerbocker's face is being lifted so much that we hardly know it as such. All the streets are being dressed up, so before they ruin Broadway, I suggest of you go to the city fathers and say, glorify 6th Avenue and put bathrooms in the zoo, but please don't mug it with Broadway. Put big floodlights in the park and put Jersey in the dark, but please don't mug it with Broadway. Though it's tawdry and plain, it's a lovely old lane full of landmarks galore and memories gay. So move Grant's tomb to Union Square and put Queens anywhere, but please, please, I beg on my knees, don't mug it.
This conversation with Patti LuPone comes from the Creative Life series, created and produced by the New York State Writers Institute, University Art Museum, and UAlbany Performing Arts Center, in collaboration with WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.